On today's 21st, the CDC has reported more than 270 Zika virus cases in the U.S. Just 9 of those are here in Illinois. But with all the confusing information out there, the Illinois Department of Public Health and others join us to help clear that up. They're taking your questions. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21st Show. Later.
Illinois, I'm going to pray because we're about to elect a man who believes in the name of Jesus Christ.
What does it mean when you hear polls indicating a sizable portion of evangelical Christians supporting Donald Trump? We'll talk about what it means to be evangelical and explore the Christian values of Trump supporters and detractors. Also, Champaign County honors its historical claim to the Tuskegee Airmen.
The Tuskegee Airmen are not just African-American history. The Tuskegee Airmen are United States history. They're the history of America.
That's all this hour. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As the Zika virus spreads throughout the Americas, how concerned should Illinois residents be? Well, if you're trying to get pregnant, the Canadian government says women who've been potentially exposed to Zika shouldn't try to get pregnant for at least 2 months, even if they haven't shown any symptoms. The CDC hasn't been so explicit in its advice. Zika spread pretty quickly through the Americas in the past 12 months, and scientists are working on understanding more about the virus. But as with many health and medical issues, there is a lot of confusing information out there. So this morning, we're going to try to give you some answers. We're going to start by speaking with two medical doctors about Zika. And if you have any questions for them, you can join us. You can call us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your questions to 21st Show. Joining us from Springfield is Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Shah.
Good morning, Nyla.
And on the line with us from Evanston, Illinois, is Dr. Michael Angaroni, an Assistant Professor of Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Northwestern University at Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Angaroni, thanks for joining us, too.
Thank you for having me on.
Let me start with you, Dr. Angaroni. What kind of questions are you hearing from your patients? We're looking at numbers right now. The CDC reporting more than 220 cases of the virus in the U.S., just 9 of those here in Illinois, and all of those cases have been travel associated. So are you hearing concern from your patients on this issue?
Yeah, I think the biggest concern that we've been hearing from patients that we see in clinic or calls that I get from other providers here at Northwestern is mostly related to what's my risk or what should I do if I get infected or should I cancel my travel plans if I'm planning on traveling to Brazil or one of the countries that are being affected currently. We haven't much had many questions related to, you know, what should we do here in Illinois at this time? And most likely, I think that's because it's too cold for the mosquitoes to start spreading the virus if the virus comes up here.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Shah, I wanted to ask you about the Illinois Department of Public Health, sort of first of all, just general advice you're offering for people here in Illinois who may be concerned about Zika.
Well, Nyla, let's start with the question that you led with in the broadcast, which is, what is the overall risk here in Illinois? And our assessment is that the risk of transmission occurring in Illinois is very low. There are a number of reasons for that, of course, one of which was already mentioned, which is that the mosquito that is most commonly associated with transmission is not really one that is typically found in Illinois. And even at the points it were found, it can't survive our harsh winters. Moreover, there are just structural differences in the environments of Illinois versus the places in South America and Central America where transmission is occurring, namely a lower population density and a difference in behaviors. We tend to go out wearing covered sleeves and tend to use more insect repellent, things of that nature. So overall, we assess the risk of any type of transmission in Illinois quite low.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, we are trying to educate individuals as much as we can. We recognize that there is a concern out there among folks to know what their risk level is. And so what we've done at the agency is try to make as much information available as possible. We've hosted a number of webinars. We update our website continually to make sure that it contains the latest information from the CDC and other authorities. And we also are working with local health departments on the ground to make sure that they have the latest information so that they can work with physicians, other providers, and the residents in their areas to make sure that everyone has the latest and most up-to-date information.
That's Dr. Nirav Shah. He's the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. With us from Chicago is Dr. Michael Angaroni, who teaches at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. His specialty is infectious diseases. So as you heard, important to note that the Illinois Department of Public Health thinks the risk here is low. This segment is an educational one for you. If you have any questions about the Zika virus, about transmission, you can join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your questions to 21st Show. Here's a question that we got on Facebook from Stephanie earlier. Stephanie wants to know if you all are anticipating that this will be spread through mosquito bites in the U.S. this summer. You know, Dr. Shah, you mentioned that we've had such cold weather so far. There's not so much a concern right now for Illinois. But what about as we now we're, well, not today, but as we're seeing weather warm up a little bit, what are we thinking about for the summer, Dr. Shah?
Even in Illinois, even in the summer months, we think that the risk of any type of spread or transmission will continue to be low. Now, there are other places in the United States, namely the southeast United States, particularly the Gulf Coast regions, where there is a possibility that the virus could spread from person to person. But our analysis suggests that the virus will probably not make it this far north up to Illinois. But as your listeners may know, there is already active transmission going on in some U.S. territories, such as Puerto Rico. But thankfully, because we are so far north, even in the hottest of the summer months, we believe that the risk of transmission still remains low.
That's Dr. Shah, and I should note to our listeners, we're going to be joined by some Puerto Rico researchers later on in the show after the break. Dr. Angaroni, I wanted to ask you about, just to kind of do some basic education for people about Zika, about its symptoms, and I wanted to ask you about that in terms of, I think it's one of the first questions I wanted to ask is it's possible to even have the Zika virus and not even know it, correct?
Correct. And from some of the estimates based on some of the earlier outbreaks in the Pacific Islands and Oceania is that a majority of individuals who become infected will be asymptomatic. So anywhere from 70% to 80% of individuals won't have any symptoms at all. The symptoms of Zika virus are very similar to a lot of other infections, especially viral infections that most of us are exposed to all the time, and especially in the areas of the world that are being affected, Zika symptoms are very similar to dengue virus and chikungunya, and they include fever and rash, body aches, muscle aches. You can get arthritis or arthralgia, so pains in the joint. Zika, probably one of the more unique features of it, tends to be a conjunctivitis or eye pain, the conjunctivitis being redness of the eyes. And a lot of individuals with Zika have been noted to have rashes as well. But the symptoms are very similar to many other infections, and specifically many other viral infections that we see throughout the world, and especially in the areas that are being affected right now.
And Dr. Angaroni, how do you know then? Is there a blood test for testing whether or not you've contracted Zika, and how accurate is that blood test?
Yeah, so currently right now for Zika, for individuals who are symptomatic or pregnant women who are symptomatic or recently returned from an area that is being affected by Zika virus, there are blood tests that can be done. And those of us that are practicing, here in Chicago or anywhere in the U.S., we actually contact the Illinois Department of Public Health to discuss with them about the case, and then we send the test off to the CDC. And currently the CDC is doing an antibody test looking for an early antibody called IgM to the Zika virus, as well as doing a genetic test, a PCR, polymerase chain reaction test, looking for the virus specifically, especially in those individuals that are symptomatic. The virus in the blood is detectable probably for those first few weeks that an individual is infected and has the symptoms. The IgM lasts for a little bit longer, maybe 2 to 4 weeks, maybe a little bit longer than that. The big problem is that there is some cross-reactivity of this virus with other viruses that are transmitted in the tropics, namely dengue virus. And so there is some cross-reactivity. So if you have a positive test for one, does that necessarily mean Zika or dengue or vice versa?
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the Zika virus with Dr. Michael Angaroni from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. On the line with us from Springfield is Dr. Nirav Shah. He's the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. And we're taking your questions, your tweets. You can tweet to 21st Show. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Here's another question that we got on Facebook. And Dr. Shah, I wanted to direct this to you, which is someone was concerned about pregnancy and Zika and wanted to know, have scientists or have medical health professionals figured out the risk as it relates to trimester?
Well, that's a great question, Nyla. The first thing to observe is that this is an area of research that is evolving almost every day. There are new data, there are new published reports that come out, new analyses. And so our understanding of Zika is evolving at light speed. And that's really a testament to the fact that there are thousands upon thousands of scientists around the world that are working on to further our knowledge about Zika virus. One of the top questions that they're working on is to assess the risk of any of the birth defects that have been associated with Zika in a woman who has been infected. Just a couple days ago, there was a paper that came out, a very preliminary analysis, but that analysis suggests that the risk is approximately 1%. It seems to be a little bit higher in the first trimester, but it also seems to exist throughout the pregnancy. But again, I want to stress that this is very preliminary data, and many, many more studies and analyses are going to be required until we can really know what the exact risk is for any woman at any time in her pregnancy.
Well, and as we talk about that, I think it's important to note there's sort of a discrepancy between, for example, what the Canadian government has said to its citizens versus what the CDC has, you know, not been as explicit. So Canadian health officials have said women should wait at least 2 months after their return from countries where Zika is circulating before trying to get pregnant. And if their partner travels to those areas, they should use condoms for at least 6 months after their return. The CDC hasn't been as specific. So, Dr. Shah, what do you think Illinois residents should think about when they're, particularly if there are women who are trying to get pregnant and maybe have a partner who's been traveling to these areas?
Well, it's a great question. The first part is what accounts for some of these differences in recommendations?
Right.
And in a situation of this sort where data are coming out every single day and our understanding is being enhanced every single day, a lot of the recommendations are based on what different folks think of as the acceptable risk tolerance in any particular situation. And no two entities or agencies will think about that in the same way. I suppose the point I would want to make for your listeners is that even though there might be slightly different recommendations coming out from some of these leading scientific bodies, that is not evidence that the scientific community doesn't know what they're talking about or doesn't know what's going on. It's really the fact that every single organization that takes a look at this is going to have a slightly different interpretation of the data in trying to match that with the risk level that they want people to take. Now, in terms of Illinois residents who might be concerned about pregnancy and any potential side effects with a partner who has traveled, we really urge folks to talk with their physician to determine what's best for them in any situation. The data suggests that the virus may be cleared from either a male or a female anywhere from 1 to 3 weeks, as Dr. Angaroni mentioned, but we don't exactly know. And so some experts think that a month is an appropriate amount of time. The Canadian government has come down on the side of 2 months. Of course, that's an area of very active research to determine what the safe period is, but it may not be for several more months until we know a more refined answer.
Dr. Angaroni, do you have an opinion on months? What are you telling your patients?
Yeah, so I agree with Dr. Shah. I think it's an area that's ever evolving. And, you know, again, it's taking into account the risk and benefit of to the patient, to the baby, that may be affected by Zika. I've been telling my patients if they're a woman and they have a male partner who has traveled to an area to wait at least 2 to 3 months before trying to get pregnant and use condoms. If the woman traveled, I've been talking to them about waiting a few months before trying to get pregnant, especially because that allows us to develop or gain more information. So as Dr. Shaw mentioned, even with the microcephaly, initially we had no idea what the numbers were, what the percents were, and now we're starting to get more refined data, although not perfect, as to what those numbers might be. And so I think even giving information to patients about waiting for a month or a few months or 3 months, that also allows us to gain more information to then give a more accurate response or answer to those patients we've already seen and those that we'll see after that.
Dr. Shaw, we just have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you a respond to one of our listeners on Twitter. Adam said that he thinks you're sugarcoating the situation with Zika and that 24/7 oversight and monitoring is required now on the Zika front in the U.S. I wanted to ask you to respond to that, and also just about really quickly, I know this week the IDHP reported the number of tuberculosis cases in Illinois increasing for the first time. We've noticed a spike in the flu. What do you think people in Illinois really should be most concerned about, especially if they're trying to become pregnant?
Sure. So with respect to your listener's question, we understand that in light of recent events with Ebola and other infectious diseases, there is a tendency to be hypervigilant and err on the side of safety in a situation where we might not know all the answers. But here, our recommendations, not just at the agency, but nationally and internationally, are based on the best available science. And the best available science suggests that the overall risk is quite low because of the way that Zika virus is transmitted by mosquitoes. That's, of course, different from some of the other diseases you mentioned, like tuberculosis. We have seen a slight increase in the number of cases in Illinois of tuberculosis, and that actually tracks a nationwide increase in the number of cases. That's due to a variety of factors. Some of it is increasing population density in some areas. Some of it in Illinois is related to concentration in jails and housing shelters.
Dr. Shaw, I'm going to have to stop you there. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Nirav Shaw, Director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Thanks also to Dr. Angaroni, who's at Northwestern University's School of Medicine.
Support for the 21st comes from the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, helping to generate new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies that better distribute scholarly knowledge. This is your university library.
This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the Zika virus and the recent spread throughout the Americas and what that means for people in Illinois. We want to shift the conversation to the science that's happening to help understand how Zika is being transmitted and how to stop its spread. We also wanted to bring you the perspective from Puerto Rico, which has more than half the cases in the U.S. Joining us in studio right now are two researchers who study mosquito-borne illnesses. Marilyn O'Hara Ruiz is a clinical associate professor of pathobiology at the University of Illinois. She also directs the Geographic Information Science and Spatial Analysis Laboratory. She's going to be giving us a little bit more perspective on how this mapping is going to help track the transmission of the virus. Marilyn, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also joining us as well is Brian Allen. He's an assistant professor of entomology, and he's going to be joining in our conversation later. I see some questions on Twitter about mosquitoes. Brian is going to be our mosquito guy and handle that in a minute. Brian, thanks for being here, too.
Yeah, happy to help.
And joining us on the line is University of Puerto Rico biology professor Miguel Acevedo Torres. Miguel, thank you for being with us as well.
Hey, thank you for inviting me. A pleasure to be here.
Now, I understand you're actually in Florida at a vector mosquito workshop. First, you have to explain, I just learned this before we went on air, the difference what a vector mosquito is versus a nuisance mosquito. Can you educate our listeners on that?
Well, I mean, I think when we're talking about vectors, we're talking about pretty much any arthropod that will spread diseases between host populations. And mosquitoes is just one type of vector, but there are many others. Ticks, for example, is a big vector of Lyme disease.
Ah, okay. Now, let me ask you about Puerto Ricans on the island. How much of this is Zika is part of the conversation? Are people discussing this? Do you find that people are worried about Zika?
Well, I mean, it's definitely part of the conversation, but you got to remember that we're not strangers to arboviruses. We have dengue. We recently have a big chikungunya outbreak in 2014. So it's in our conversations, but I think travelers going to Puerto Rico are, I think, a little bit more worried than the locals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And by the way, as we have all these people on the line, I should note to everyone who's listening, if you have questions for them, you can always give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet us, tweet to 21st Show. And Miguel, so we're looking at about 341 confirmed cases of Zika in U.S. territories, which includes Puerto Rico. Roughly 40 of those cases are pregnant women. What challenges are health officials facing in the effort to stop the spread of Zika, particularly on the island?
Well, I think one of the most important challenges is that we don't know much about the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So Zika, I mean, we have very little information about it. And the second one is that the data that it's coming, it's very noisy. It's not very clear data. There are many cases that are not being reported. So that's actually a challenge for the people that are trying to manage the disease in the field.
Mm-hmm. And what are the big questions that, as you said, there's a lot of things that we don't know about it. So what are the big questions on researchers' minds right now about Zika?
I mean, I'm a modeler, so I like mathematical models. So one of the questions that we have from the modeling perspective is, what's the probability of infection? Once a mosquito that is infected bites a human, what's the probability of getting infected? And that's something that we're trying to estimate with the data that it's becoming slowly available.
Mm-hmm. And I know there's some research questions you're hoping to get funding to be able to address.
We're actually trying to get funding to develop a mathematical framework, a statistical framework that actually allows public management agencies to make the most out of this noisy Zika data. And one of the cool things that we're trying to do with this model is actually use information that we previously have on other arboviruses like dengue and chikungunya to try to inform the first stages of the management plans and then update that information with the data that is coming with for Zika.
Mm-hmm. And now I asked you that question because, Marilyn, I know you're hoping to work with Miguel on this. You're a professor of pathobiology. As Miguel's talking to us about sort of all the noise out there, I wonder how geographic information sciences and how all of this numerical data and creating maps can kind of help maybe filter out some of that.
Right, that's a good question. So one of the things that we do with the mapping is try to see what kind of vegetation is there, what kind of housing there is, or even how people might behave differently in different places. And then we're able to see better what kinds of things might be protective and what other things might be adding to people's risk of being exposed.
And you've done previous research on this with the West Nile virus. What did you learn from how did that, and I know you did previous research on West Nile virus's outbreak here in Illinois. How do you think that's applicable to looking at Zika spread in Puerto Rico or other parts of the world?
I think one of the big things that we see when we look at West Nile is that it's definitely more common in certain neighborhoods than others, but the mosquitoes are not always as reliably predictive as we'd like them to be, that they can really have each year the weather changes. Just small things can change, and it makes it so there's more mosquitoes or there's different events that can get in the way of things being very predictable. So I think with West Nile, that's probably one of the biggest things that we've seen. And West Nile really wasn't or isn't a very strong problem in Illinois, but an ongoing one. And so I think also just seeing that we aren't just going to solve this in 1 year or in one action. I think it's an ongoing kind of a set of things that we want to do to try to keep the risk down.
Mm-hmm. And Miguel, when you're talking about, as we're listening to Marilyn speak about sort of what we learn about where mosquitoes are in Illinois, I mean, what I imagine it's a little bit different in Puerto Rico. What kind of information will you be adding, assuming that you all get this funding to kind of help map this out more?
Well, I've never been to Chicago, so I don't know about the conditions in Chicago, but definitely
not as humid, I'll tell you that.
Puerto Rico will be a little bit different, right? We're a subtropical region, and we know very little about what's happening at very local scales, at the scale of households. When you have vector habitat and we have mosquito habitats and how people are getting exposed to the different mosquitoes. And that's a big unknown, and how this translates into the transmission process at larger scales, at the scales that Marilee works on. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do, to come up with mathematical ways and try to scale up that information and also account for those uncertainties.
That's Miguel Acevedo Torres. He's a biology professor at the University of Puerto Rico, actually joining us from Florida in studio with me, Marilyn O'Hara Ruiz, who teaches pathobiology at the University of Illinois. And I promised that we would have, I feel like we've gotten to the point now where we need to bring in our mosquito guy, which is Brian Allen, who teaches entomology at the University of Illinois as well. Brian, maybe you can explain for us. We've heard a couple mosquitoes come up. Maybe you can explain the specific mosquito that carries the Zika virus, as we've heard carries lots of other dengue chikungunya. But what do we know about these mosquitoes? There's two specific species that are suspected of being able to carry Zika, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And so the short answer is we don't know as much as we'd like to about that. So we're fairly confident that Aedes aegypti is the primary vector mosquito, particularly in this outbreak that's taking place in the Americas. What we don't know is that there's this other mosquito, Aedes albopictus, also known as the Asian tiger mosquito. And what role is it going to play? It has a broader distribution, and so it could, if it...
Including here in Illinois.
Yeah, it has been recently found here in Illinois. And so if it is going to be a competent vector for Zika virus, that's something we'd like to know. And so that's an area of ongoing research.
And so the Aedes mosquito, for people maybe know the name of the Asian tiger mosquito, mm-hmm. right? That's the one with the black and white kind of, like... I guess stripes
yeah,
on its legs
exactly
would maybe
right.
be. So how is that different? And we know that Asian tiger mosquitoes in other parts of the world have been shown to transmit Zika, right?
That's right, but those are different populations
so we
in
don't
other
know.
Parts of the
okay.
world. So we really can't say with certainty at this point what is the role that the Asian tiger mosquito is going to play in transmission here in the Americas. Aedes aegypti, which is also known as the yellow fever mosquito, we're fairly confident that that's the mosquito that's been responsible for the majority of the transmission so far.
And what do we know, Brian, about mosquitoes and what needs to happen to eradicate Zika? I know there's been really interesting things and pretty controversial in Florida about introducing, for example, genetically modified male mosquitoes. What has to happen?
Right. So there's been a lot of work done on mosquito control over the years. And so we've tried a lot of different technologies. Some are tried and true, but these are difficult mosquitoes to control. Aedes aegypti in particular, it's an indoor mosquito. So it lives in people's houses. It bites during the day. And so some of the things we use to control malaria, like bed nets, just aren't really effective for disrupting Zika transmission. And so scientists are increasingly experimenting with more modern technologies and approaches, and some of these include ideas like genetic engineering to see if we can introduce genetically modified mosquitoes that can somehow disrupt reproduction in wild mosquitoes, so cause them to produce non-viable offspring that could then reduce their population sizes.
And how has that experiment gone in Key West, Florida? Because that's been the only place in the U.S., am I right, that that's happened?
There
that we've been a public experiment with genetically modified mosquitoes introduced into just, you know, outside of a laboratory setting?
There was a previous release that I think really resulted in inconclusive results. There's currently a proposal for another release of these engineered mosquitoes in one of the keys near to Key West. And it's currently in a period of public evaluation. The FDA appears to have cautiously signed off on allowing it to move forward. But there's a fair bit of public resistance to this idea of releasing mosquitoes that have been genetically engineered. And so it's currently in that phase where it's being evaluated and receiving public comment.
And I wonder, as people read about that, they probably just read about the controversy. So as someone who studies the science of this, what would you say to people who are really worried about the idea of scientists who are saying, oh, we think this is maybe a good way to solve this?
I mean, I think the efforts to determine what could be any negative consequences of this have been fairly exhaustive. And so I think the risk of some unanticipated outcome is fairly low. I think the bigger concern from my perspective is whether this is the best use of resources. So will this really result in effective mosquito control and represent the best use of those funds that could otherwise be directed towards established techniques? I think the reality is we have to perform some of these types of what you would call wild mosquito experiments to really figure out is if this is a technology that can be used to reduce transmission of diseases.
And when we think about this, I wanted to ask, we just have a couple minutes left before we wrap up this conversation. So I wanted to ask Marilyn and Brian and Miguel, if you're still with us, just what you think, what people need to take away from this. Do people need to be concerned about Zika? Do you think it's overblown? Do you think we should be just focusing more on big picture mosquito-borne illnesses? Marilyn, let's start with you.
Sure. I think one of the big, messages that we've seen both with Ebola and with Zika is that we do have these infectious diseases coming through, and that a strong public health system is something that we just have to be vigilant about. We can't just leave it to only when there is an outbreak or when there's a big emergency. And I think that we should use whatever we can to really learn the lessons from this, but also to look toward the future, and that there will be other risks in the future that we want to be prepared for.
Miguel, what do you think?
Well, I think also there's a research component. So we don't know much about these emerging diseases, and funding for research, it's very, very competitive. So I think if the public is concerned or even curious about these things, they should take the phone and call their congresswoman or congressman and talk to them about how they can fund more projects about these diseases.
Brian, I'll give you the last word here.
Well, I couldn't agree with Miguel more. But I think the other thing we need to, I don't mean to be fatalistic in saying this, but I think these types of events are going to keep happening. We didn't expect chikungunya to come through. We didn't expect Zika to come through. But given the now global distribution of these vector mosquitoes, I think this has to be approached as though it's our new reality and invest our resources accordingly.
That's Brian Allen. He's assistant professor of entomology at the University of Illinois. His other U of I colleague, Marilyn O'Hara Ruiz, has also been our guest, where she is director of the Geographic Information Sciences and Spatial Analysis Lab. And I want to thank also Miguel Acevedo Torres joining us from Florida. He's a University of Puerto Rico biology professor. Thank you.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
Seventy-five years ago this week, the Tuskegee Airmen Squadron was first activated. What you may not know is that happened here in central Illinois. Yesterday, a group gathered at the Urbana National Guard Armory in Champaign County to honor the area's ties to the Tuskegee Airmen. Jeff Bossert has this audio postcard for us.
Despite the racial climate in the country, a lot of those talents that were achieved by these individuals called the Tuskegee Airmen were never realized in the civilian world, even though a lot of them went on to become doctors, lawyers, teachers, even very important executives in major corporations.
Many communities did not want African-American pilots in their airspace. Just one small symptom of the rampant racism that we in America are ashamed to admit and that has been an ongoing battle for generations. Detroit was an option to train the airmen. Detroit rejected having African-American pilots in their airspace. Rantoul Airfield said yes. Yes, we will have African-American pilots in our airspace.
What was interesting about Bev Dunchel is that he would always talk to young people, and he would tell people, as a coach would, you're limited only by your own vision. So he said, if you sat on the end of a runway and you're ready to fly, you don't look down. You don't just look straight out. Elevate your perspective. Look up. So you would always tell young people your goals and you're measuring your progress towards achieving those goals. That was critically important.
What we plan to do for the rest of our lives to preserve the legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen is to get their story told to everyone who will listen, because it's a story for everyone. The Tuskegee Airmen are not just African-American history, not something that should just be celebrated during Black History Month. The Tuskegee Airmen are United States history. They're the history of America.
Four road signs entering Champaign County now signify the area's ties to the African-American pilots who flew in World War II. You're listening to The 21st Show. You can always connect with us via social media. Search for The 21st Show on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. Our handle is at 21st Show. Coming up, there appears to be significant support for Donald Trump among evangelical Christians. Up next, we're going to look into that issue and speak with Christians who are sharply divided on this. As always, you can join our conversation by tweeting. Like I said, you can tweet to 21st Show or you can give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. Stay tuned.
Support for the 21st comes from the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, hosting the annual Edible Book Festival on April 4th at 11:30 at the University YMCA. Participants create dishes inspired by fiction or nonfiction literary works or characters. This is your University Library.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Hello, Illinois! Are you ready to elect the next president of these United States of America? And he is going to make sure we are protected and our rights as Christians are protected that has been taken away by the Obama administration.
That's South Carolina pastor Mark Burns welcoming a crowd of 3,000 Trump supporters at a rally in Bloomington a couple of weeks ago. That video, by the way, courtesy of Patriotic Populist. We're not sure how many among that rally that day would call themselves evangelical Christians, but one recent NBC poll says Trump is winning almost 40% of the white evangelical Christian support. But how much support is there really among the evangelical Christian community for Trump? That turns out to be a not-so-simple answer and something we're going to tackle for the rest of the 21st for today. Pastor Burns is going to join us in a minute along with Moody Bible Institute Professor Clive Cragen. But before we bring them on, let's get some more context on what it means to be evangelical and why polls have varying degrees of support for Trump. So I'd like to welcome Richard Clark. He's the online managing editor for Christianity Today magazine based in Wheaton, Illinois. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, great to be here.
So I think we should start this conversation with a simple question. How do you define evangelical?
That is theoretically a simple question.
Okay.
It's actually pretty complex, and part of the reason is because there's been a lot of discussion around that recently. At this point, I think the thing I'm most comfortable with is defining it by belief rather than behavior or things like belonging, so how you describe yourself. My feeling is that what makes an evangelical is what they believe, not the fact that they call themselves evangelicals, which is a big difference, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so do most polls ask people to self-define then?
So, yeah, most political polls in particular will ask, you know, how do you call yourself an evangelical? So they're based mostly on belonging.
Mm-hmm. And you all have a Barna poll that takes a little bit different tack on this, right? Because you ask some fairly rigorous questions, 9 questions to be exact. What kind of questions do you ask people to see if you, and as you said, to get at what people actually believe versus how people label themselves?
Yeah, so those questions are basically revolving around things like church attendance, morality, the ideas of like, what you believe about Jesus, what you believe about theology. And that one in particular combines behavioral things with theology, with belief. So it is extremely, it's extremely sort of limited in scope in terms of how it defines an evangelical. It definitely provides a better picture of what a typical evangelical would be like. And then from that allows us to extrapolate all sorts of things they would, you know, say, and then we can associate with an evangelical.
Mm-hmm. What kind of questions? So what kind of questions, like what questions would you ask someone about Jesus, for example, or maybe about how they believe or maybe how they look at the Bible?
Yeah. The idea of do you believe the Bible is the highest authority for what I believe? The idea that only those who trust in Jesus Christ alone as their Savior receive eternal salvation. Those are sort of the beliefs that are fairly limiting, right? Like those are things that I don't know if all of those people that would call themselves evangelicals would, when it comes down to it, say, yeah, I believe that, if they were asked by a pollster.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're asked if they're an evangelical, they might say, sure.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I thought was interesting in your Barna poll is there are groups of people who are Christian who say they're not evangelical, but they say they're born again. So, and those are people you found who support, in your polling, those are the people you found who support Trump.
Yeah.
But what does that mean if you say you're evangelical, but you're not evangelical, but you are born again?
Right. That's a really good question. I think there's a lot of people who are uncomfortable with the term evangelical because, maybe largely because of the way that's been presented in political polling. One interesting thing that I would point out is that whenever we see evangelical in sort of the public sphere in polling, it's presented next to the word white. So it's white evangelicals who are presented as, you know, largely Cruz and Trump supporters and Rubio supporters, sort of equally that, and largely Republican, right? But there's, if you look at the NEA, the suggested sort of NEA, National Association of Evangelicals, and the Lifeway partnership poll, they found that actually like 44% of African Americans fall as evangelicals, compared to something like 36% of white Americans. So there's actually like a big misunderstanding, I think, in terms of the difference between someone who calls themselves an evangelical and someone who believes evangelical, has evangelical beliefs.
Right. And really quickly for you, two last questions for you. First, what percentage of, and then do we even know, it sounds so squishy, what percentage of people who are evangelical represent part of the voting electorate overall?
Sorry, say that question again.
So what percentage of voters would identify as evangelical in the American voting population?
Would identify as evangelical, uh-huh. Probably something like 70%.
70% of the American voting population?
Off the top of my head.
Okay. And then, so then I guess my last question to you is, obviously, you work with a major Christian magazine. I feel like you have an eye on this conversation about particularly Donald Trump in particular. How do you see, I mean, do you see, where do you see his support lying in the community just based on your knowledge of the area?
I think that among evangelical leaders, what's really clear is that it's very, very low. So among Protestant pastors, for instance, which is a really easy thing to determine.
There's no question about figuring out who's a Protestant pastor. Okay.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that 5% of Protestant pastors are Trump supporters, according to some polling. And the thing that I would say that's most clear to me is that when I talk to people who fall in this category of evangelical Christian, they are not a voting bloc. They're not a group of people who agree. I would say it's about half Republican and half Democrat at this point. I would say, you know, a lot of those Republicans are differ quite a bit on what they're looking for in a presidential candidate. And I haven't, one thing that has happened over and over is I really have a hard time finding evangelical Trump supporters. It's just a tough thing to do. And especially ones who are leaders among evangelicals.
Well, thanks for joining us. That's Richard Clark. He's an online managing editor of Christianity Today, a magazine based in Wheaton, Illinois. Joining us now are two guests on the line. One minister who you just heard of, who does very clearly support Donald Trump. He's the pastor of the Harvest Praise and Worship Center in Greenville, South Carolina, CEO of the Now Television Network, and who you heard earlier welcoming the crowd in Bloomington a couple weeks ago. Pastor Mark, thanks for being with us.
So happy to be here.
Also on the line with us from Chicago, Clive Craven. He's a professor of intercultural studies at Moody Bible Institute. Clive, thanks for being with us as well.
That's my pleasure.
Pastor Mark, you were just listening to that conversation. I just want to make clear to our listeners, you do self-identify as an evangelical Christian, correct?
And I do. I do. I sure do.
And what are your priorities as a Christian voter? Why are you so vocal about your support for Donald Trump?
Well, you know, there are several things. Number one, Donald Trump has been very clear on his strong defense of the Christian faith, in which, in today's time, we believe the Christian faith has come under major attack, especially from our federal government and with our sitting president, who has declared this is no longer a Judeo-Christian nation, when in fact the majority of Americans, as you just said, identify themselves as Christians. And so not only that, he has a strong stance for same-sex marriage. He believes marriage is between one man and one woman. And he also is a pro-life, and which I've coined pro-babies, candidate. He loves babies. In today's time, we have, and especially within the African-American community, over 14% of abortions were done by black women. And that makes up about, since 1973, about 15 million black babies have been killed. I'm a strong believer in pro-life.
So, Pastor Mark, would you say those are your priorities as a Christian, as a Christian pastor and a voter? Would you say that abortion and those abortion pro-life issues are your number one priority as a voter? Where would you kind of rank them if you could give me your top three?
Well, I rank obviously marriages. I think
same-sex marriage.
Marriage is a caricature of our relationship with God. And so right now, the government is redefining what marriage really is. And I think that is the number one issue with many evangelical voters and Christians alike. But also abortion, it ranks right behind it.
Clive, what about you? What are your priorities as a Christian voter?
If I think about a Christian voter, while I share convictions with regards to some of those things, my priorities would probably lean more towards issues of justice, issues of freedom of religious expression, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you've said, and I mean, you have issues that concern you about Donald Trump, and you think those are issues directly involved with your faith. What are they?
Well, I think for evangelicals who have historically been voted values in terms of character and decency and things like that. It seems to me, and I don't think I'm alone, that Donald Trump has demonstrated a low level of decency in terms of language and mockery of people and things like that. And so I would say that while I may not, I'm concerned that somebody would be have those kinds of ideas and attitudes and be so free with them. I just think there's a lack of virtue and decency there.
I wanted to bring up a question that a comment that we got on Facebook. And Pastor Mark, I wanted to direct this to you because as we were talking to Richard about this before, about what tends to be the difference oftentimes on this issue between white evangelical and black evangelical support. And Pastor Mark, it seems like you are sort of the rare African-American minister who is supporting Donald Trump. This is the comment that we got from Alicia on Facebook. I think there's a racial divide on evangelical support, and I think that's telling. Is there something about the intersection of whiteness and evangelicalism to interrogate here? My opinion is a sizable segment of white Christians are more interested in being white than they are in being Christian. Pastor Mark, what would you say as an African-American who supports Donald Trump? An African-American Christian, obviously.
Well, again, I think the racial divide obviously goes way beyond just political political desire. In my case, you know, again, I'm from a very strong Southern black African-American family who has deep roots dealing with racial division, et cetera, et cetera. And even right now, Sundays are still in the South. Still, even now, the most segregated day of the week. My church is one of those rare churches that bring races together, but in most cases, church even now is still racially divided. And so when it comes to voting, how it translates, what the black families that I'm connected to, many blacks are also more outweigh being black more than being Christian.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, Pastor Mark.
I was right there in the middle of the meeting when we first had the meeting with Donald Trump, and all the black pastors who came there, and privately, many of them was in agreement, but then publicly they were not in agreement because it became more important to be publicly black versus publicly Christian.
Let me ask you, Pastor Mark, because we just have about a minute left, so I want to ask both of you just this one very simple question, which is some people say that ministers shouldn't be involved in politics at all, and I wanted to ask just both of you really quickly your thoughts on that. Pastor Mark?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm an American first, I'm just a human being. I don't think I'm standing up in the forefront using my title or my office. Even though I am a pastor and a minister, it is not my title that I am using to influence. I just use my character and who I am as a person. I don't put on Christianity. I am a Christian. You know, I don't go to work as a minister. It is who I am. It's my calling. And so they're all in one. of course, in the civil rights movement, pastors and leaders led the social injustice movement. Christianity within the black community, pastors in the black community were heavily involved in the political.
Thanks for that, Pastor Mark. Let me just stop you there so Clive has a minute to respond also. Clive?
I think that if we truly believe that Jesus Christ is Lord, then as followers of Jesus, we should be speaking and interacting and processing in all parts of life and not just, quote, within the church. And it's because it's who we are wherever we go, not, as Pastor Mark said, it's our identity. So I think pastors should speak to it and challenge people to.
Thanks for that. That's Clive Cragen. He's a professor of intercultural studies at Moody Bible Institute. Pastor Mark, pastor of the Harvest Praise and Worship Center in Greenville, South Carolina. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me on this Good Friday.
Thank you.
Blessings.
Thanks to everyone for listening. Have a great holiday weekend. Have a good Easter.